This is the first day of this January 2010 Rohatsu 7-day session. And going to start this session reading from the biography of Zen Master Hakuin, who's Zazen Wasan, the chant and praise of Zazen that we just recited, that we recite before every Teisho. This is from a new book called Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave. And the subtitle is A Zen Miscellany. And it's edited and translated by Norman Waddell. The subtitle, as it suggests, it's a collection of several texts that includes this biography of Hakuin, as well as teachings, other texts by him. This is a long biography, and it means that I'm going to do something I've never done before, which is to spend several successive teishos reading from a single biography. The reason I think it's worth doing, rather than doing my usual practice of after the first day giving a biography, then going on to read the actual teachings of the master. But this is, Hakuin is such an illustrious master, widely seen in Japan as one of the two greatest lights of Japanese Zen, along with Dogen, that it's an unusually inspiring biography for being so long, especially. Anyone can pull out the highlights of the biographies of these masters, and there could be plenty inspiring. But here we're taken through, year by year, we're taken through the life of Hakuin and are given much more detail than we get from most biographies, starting right from his childhood. The biography was done by his Dharma heir, Tore Enji. But it wasn't really published by Tore, it was published by a disciple of Tore's. Hakuin lived in the late 1600s and much of the 1700s. He died not that long after our own Declaration of Independence was signed in the late 1700s. I'll read here from the little introduction to the biography. It's actually called the Chronological Biography of Zen Master Hakuin. And it was compiled during Hakuin's own lifetime by his successor, Tore. And it's the only translation in this book that is about and not by Hakuin, though, as will be seen, he did have a hand in producing it. It is one of the three principal sources for Hakuin's life, the only one that covers it from birth to death and provides an extensive account of the teaching career that dominated his final 40 years. It follows the... I'm speaking now for myself. It follows the general format of a biography of its time. Biographies then of the masters were uncritical and reverential treatments of the person's achievements, designed for posterity, and normally consisting of a good deal of rather dry narrations of what he did and when and where he did it. They are largely accurate, though they generally manage to include at least one or two stories or legends of an inspirational nature as well. Just one more paragraph from the introduction. These are the translator's words. Given that the biography was compiled largely during Hakuin's lifetime, and given Toray's relative youth when he started it, it is natural to assume that the project was conceived by Hakuin himself and that he played some role in its composition, providing valuable information and guidance, and perhaps even writing portions of the text. This, and the fact that normally a teacher's disciples initiated such religious biographies post-mortem, means that Toray was placed in a somewhat novel and at times one suspects a bit ticklish situation. Hakuin was enormously pleased to have acquired such a talented and dedicated young disciple to carry on his Zen teaching. He quickly appointed him as a special attendant and assigned him a teaching role as well as literary tasks. But Toray was less than eager to go along with some of Hakuin's proposals. While, of course, deeply respecting his teacher, he apparently felt that completing his training was the first order of business. So it is not hard to imagine the interplay between the two men on the issue of the biography. The teacher cajoling the student to accept the formidable assignment, and the student, perhaps with reservations, accepting. Then the teacher, whose hands-on approach to almost everything is well substantiated, looking over the student's shoulder, so to speak, as the work progressed, and rallying him on with words of encouragement and supplies of fresh information. And this one last thing, although it was compiled during Hakuin's life by his successor, Toray, it wasn't published until 50 years after Hakuin's death. In 1820. So he died in 1770. Just before the our independence. All right, I'm just going to wade into this now, and it's because it's so long, I will be skipping clumps of it that I feel are not as valuable or inspiring. He was born in 1685, on the 25th day of the 12th month. Whenever we read of the what month it was, it always means the lunar month, which varies from year to year. His family was a descendant of a clan of samurai that had an outstanding reputation for bravery and valor. The master's mother, and throughout, Toray uses this, when he refers to Hakuin, he refers to him as the master. The master's mother was from a family that had for generations devoted themselves to cultivating the seeds of Buddhahood through various religious activities. The master's mother was a simple, good-natured woman who took pleasure in spontaneous acts of kindness and compassion. I don't know if they were random acts of kindness, but they were spontaneous. Describes a dream she had that at the time of when her son was conceived. He was the third and the youngest son, in a family of five kids. And then it starts, age two. Get a load of this. You know, there's a lot of cultural aspects to this biography, and I'll read directly from it, even though it may strike us as quaint, because Hakuin was a product of his culture, as of course every one of us is, and we can get a better understanding of him with a fuller understanding of the context in which he grew up. The master felt ashamed because he was unable to stand by himself. One day, after trying again and again, he finally succeeded. Seeing his beaming face, a man exclaimed, "He's done it. The master can stand." We can assume that this is metaphorical, that it's really pointing to the kind of turnabout that can happen when one makes a strong enough effort. And in the case of the Japanese culture, if one is ashamed enough to have not accomplished it. Age three, the master had an excellent memory. He memorized a popular song of more than 300 words. He sang it wherever he went, never forgetting or mistaking a single word. People remarked on his cleverness and quickness of mind. Age four, one day a young family servant took the master along with her when she went down to the beach with the other servant girls to play. The master wandered off, found a quiet spot by himself to sit, and sat there gazing southward out to sea. His attention fixed on the clouds, endlessly changing as they moved across the sky. How strange and deceptive, he thought. He had, by chance, experienced for the first time the sad condition of life's impermanence. He suddenly burst into tears and continued to wail inconsolably. No one could understand why. The passing nature of the clouds is a classic metaphor for the impermanence of this world of phenomena against the background of the unchanging. Age six, the master enjoyed visiting temples and listening to the Dharma. One day he memorized a talk he heard a temple priest give on the Lotus Sutra. Skipping a few paragraphs here now. Well, I'll just read some little nuggets of he ran into some other kind of a Buddhist master who visited the house. Remember, he's just 6 years old now, and this Kyu Shinbo imparted three secrets to the master. Number one, after you have eaten, consume all particles of food that remain in your bowl by adding hot water and drinking it. Does that sound familiar? Number two, always assume a crouching position when you urinate, never while standing. And three, exercise great care with regard to the northern quarter. Never face north when you relieve yourself. Never sleep with your feet pointing north. Apparently, north the orientation to the north would be the one held in highest respect for some reason, and so you wouldn't urinate facing that way or even extend your feet in that direction while sleeping. Feet are considered quite low in Japan and probably China. I do want to speak up for urinating from a crouching position, especially in the middle of the night when you can hardly see what you're doing. It's I heard this from some of my European students recommended it, and I've taken to it, especially when you don't have to go through all the rigmarole of unbuckling or unzipping, and just it's very relaxing. I recommend it. Age 10, unusually large for his age, the master was strong and absolutely fearless. He never backed away from anything once he had started it. This reminds me of what the biography of Basui, Japanese Zen Master Basui, reported about him as a boy. One day his mother took him to a village temple. It wasn't a Zen temple, but another Buddhist temple. And the priest warned the people about the portents of divine punishment and described the terrible forms of retribution awaiting them in hell. This is certainly in Asia, it was always and still is a big part of popular Buddhism for the masses, the descriptions of hell and images and art of all the various hells that await those who violate the precepts. But the biographer goes on, the sermon made the master's flesh creep, his hair rose up on end, and he trembled from head to foot. I've always been fond of killing living things, he reflected. I'm wild and unruly and forever making mischief. What chance will I have to avoid falling into hell and undergoing those endless torments? Do what he would, he was unable to banish these thoughts from his mind. Of course, these reports from his childhood would have come from him, looking over the shoulder of his biographer, Tore. One day his mother took him to the bath. She directed one of the servant girls to stoke the fire under the tub to heat the water. Soon, angry sounds came snarling up from the fire under the iron bath cauldron. Fierce flames licked up and around the sides. The steam pricked against his skin with growing force like a rain of arrows. Suddenly, remembering the priest's descriptions of the torments that were inflicted on those who in hell, he burst into loud, bawling tears. No one could get him to stop. Finally, his mother's features hardened. "What a little sissy you are," she said sternly, "acting like a baby girl." Choking back tears, the master blubbered. "But mother, I'm afraid of the awful torments that await me in hell. It terrifies me just to go into the bath with you. What will become of me if I fall into the dark, burning hell pits all alone without you? Who would come and save me?" And then she softened and said some things that consoled him a little bit, but it didn't remove from him this underlying fear of karmic retribution, which turned out to be real fuel for his longing for enlightenment. And he's not the only one I've read about from in Zen. There were some others who also had this kind of fear and made it work for them, as in that it could focus their minds and really motivate them to transcend this worldly life. In trying to settle him down, she suggested that he go pray to some deity, some local deity, Tenjin. Then it reports here, the master clapped his hands together with delight. From then on, he entrusted himself single-mindedly to Tenjin's divine power. Every morning, he poured 3 buckets of cold water over his head, offering fervent prayers to the deity, and awaited some sign of response. He hung an image of this Tenjin on the wall. He lit a stick of incense. He made 2 bows and addressed the deity. If I have any chance of achieving my goal, please make the smoke from this incense rise in a straight line. He sat there for a long time in silent prayer, then opened his eyes. A thread of smoke rose straight up to the ceiling. Then a draft of air came in. The smoke billowed and scattered in all directions. The fear that he would be unable to escape Mara's evil clutches remained undispelled. Then he heard about Kanon and the spiritual potency of Kanon and the power of the Kanon-gyo and the Daishin, that they surpassed all other religious texts, and he memorized them both and began to recite them diligently. The Daishin, by the way, I didn't learn until late in my career. The Daishin is called, in English, is called the Dharani of the Great Compassionate One. So it is a Dharani in honor of Kanon. And then we also have the much shorter, the Kanon-gyo, the 10-verse Kanon-gyo that we do, both of those in our chants. There was a master, a Japanese master, I'm forgetting who said, if you chant the Daishin, there's nothing else you need to do. This 10-verse Kanon Sutra is from the Lotus. It's a chapter from the Lotus Sutra, which became very important to Hakuin. And he's now 11 years old, and he went to some festival, some annual festival, at the shrine of this Tenjin deity. And the local youths were playing out a skit about the interrogation and torture of someone. And one of the people there said, is it true what is said about practicers of the Lotus Sutra being able to enter fire without being harmed, that they can be submerged underwater without drowning? When the official confirmed that yes, it is true, the officials in this skit, the officials have a red hot iron cauldron placed over his head, but thanks to the divine power of the Lotus Sutra, he remains perfectly cool and composed throughout the terrible ordeal. So watching the play, the master felt more than a touch of envy. He went home and spent the next several days reciting this Kanon Sutra and the Daishin. He then tested himself by heating an iron tong and touching it against his thigh. The result was the same as it would have been before all the sutra chanting, a painful burn. Again, his spirits plunged. His distress and fear grew even more acute. And then he thought to himself, unless I leave home and family and enter the undefiled and emancipated realm of the monkhood, how can I ever hope to attain a free and unobstructed mind? He implored his parents on bended knees to allow him to become a priest, a monk, but they refused even to consider it. Age 12, having reached the conclusion that the confusion and defilements of worldly life were not congenial to religious practice, the master climbed a local mountain to seek a spot more favorable to self-discipline. He came upon a flat rock in the middle of a mountain stream. Would have been very cold water, of course. He's totally removed from the world and its dust. He took a chisel and carved a likeness of Kanon into the face of the cliff, and he began reciting the Diamond Sutra and the Kanon Sutra and the Dai Shin. He continued this practice every day, visiting the spot in the morning and not leaving until nightfall. Age 13, he learned to read Chinese texts. He had the entire Kuzoshi, a Zen phrase anthology, by heart, memorized in just 3 months. Once he had something memorized, he never forgot it. Afterwards, when he took part in Dharma dialogues and engaged in koan study, when he composed linked verses or impromptu poems, he was able to do it without giving much thought to it. It came easily to him, like producing articles at will from his pocket. He went to his parents again, asked to be there for their permission to enter the monkhood. Again, they refused, but now they were starting to realize that he wouldn't be denied that for forever. And they finally relented when he was 14. Took him to a local priest at the local temple called Shōinji. Now, Shōinji became the home temple of Hakuin, and that's where there is a memorial to him, a statue still to this day. Some of our members have actually visited Shōinji. This was the initial novice ceremony for Hakuin. And he was given the name Ekkaku, which means wise crane. Now, age 15, one morning the master heaved a deep sigh and said, "In deciding to become a monk, I turned my back on the obligation I had to my dear parents. Yet I haven't seen any glimpse of progress." People say the Lotus Sutra is the king among all sutras. Even evil demons and malignant spirits are said to revere it. It can save you from samsaric torments even when someone else recites it on your behalf. How much more effective it must be when you recite it yourself. Surely such a sutra, with its unsurpassed profundity, should be able to help me fulfill the vow I have made. So here he's still petitioning Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to help him in his quest. He borrowed a copy of the Lotus Sutra and read it carefully from cover to cover. but he found it merely devoted to teachings of cause and effect, couched in the form of parables. He closed the book with a deep sigh. If there is any religious merit in this sutra, it must also be found in the Chinese histories, the ancient philosophers, no chants, and even geisha songs. So here was the disillusionment. The disappointment of this discovery threw him into great mental unrest. He began to doubt the means employed in Zen's special transmission apart from the sutras. So it sounds as though, at this point, he was still equating Zen with, or largely equating Zen with, the Lotus Sutra. And I must say I share his disappointment in the Lotus Sutra. That's too bad. I don't say that with any pride, because there are those who find great inspiration from it, and that's wonderful that they can. But his response to it, his reaction is very much the same as my own. It's just all these parables and stories that are fine as far as they go, but they're hardly the real essence of the Buddha Dharma. At age 18, he went to some village and hung up his traveling staff in the training hall of a temple there. And he decided that he would devote his efforts to performing prostrations and reciting sutras. So he still hasn't gotten on to just the pure sitting. And now he encounters a story that made things even worse for him. And that's the story of the great Chinese master Yen Tao. This is the one who'd been murdered by bandits. When they cut off his head, his death cry was heard for miles around. This bit of news dealt the master's hopes a heavy blow. If even the great Yen Tao could not protect his own life from bandits in this world, he felt that his own prospects of avoiding hell in the next were slim indeed. Master Yen Tao was praised as a phoenix of the patriarchal groves, a dragon of the Buddha seas. If that is the best such a great Zen master can do, he reflected, what chance does someone like me have escaping the tortures of hell? If I am to judge from his story, it is hard to see what is to be gained from studying Zen at all. Ah, how can I entrust myself to a teaching that is so false and unreliable? You can see that poor Hakuin went through tremendous doubt in his early years before his enlightenment. He sank into to despair once again. Food lost all taste for him. I would be so bold as to hypothesized that he was really in a state that could be called a clinical depression at this point. I think that that today he could even be considered as being a bipolar personality. Later on, there's much more of the mania, the up, the high. At this point, he's still struggling with the lows. Food lost all taste for him. Now that I've left my home and family for the monkhood, he thought, brooding to himself, I can't just turn around and become a layman again. It would be too humiliating. I'm trapped. I can't go forward. I can't turn back. But if I do end up in hell, at least I'll be down there enduring the torments together with Tanrei, Sokudo, and all those other Buddhist teachers who have lived before me. I'll be better off just enjoying life, giving free rein to my inclinations and desires. This is something not unheard of in other religions and spiritual literature generally, of swinging from the heights of inspiration to the depths of discouragement, and when in the depths, just feeling inclined to give oneself over to all of one's base temptations and cravings. There's a story I once heard, I don't know where this came from, about a certain earnest practitioner who spent many years sitting ardently, and after, I think what I heard, this is a long time ago I heard this, so it's not the most reliable account, but that after 20 or 30 years of practice, he finally, in despair, gave up and set off for the local brothel. And as he was going up the steps to the brothel, he had a great enlightenment. Now, at the age of 19, he went to train under a teacher named Bao, B-A-O. And while he was there, he became friends with another monk, and the two of them pursued the study of literature. However, one day it dawned on the master that even if he succeeded in becoming a writer of surpassing skill, it still would not bring him peace of mind. That same day, the books in the temple library had been brought out and placed outside one of the halls for the annual airing. This is a custom in Japan to bring out the scrolls. I heard about the scrolls and the cushions. I hadn't heard about books, but in any case, to bring them out on a bright, sunny day of low humidity and let these things air out. I think much of Japan is terribly humid, so that would be understandable that would be an annual event. But anyway, these books were brought out to be aired out. Climbing the steps to the hall, the master saw books of all kinds, Buddhist and non-Buddhist alike, stacked in piles on top of some tables. He approached, bowed reverently before them, and prayed as follows: Confucius, Buddha, Lao Tzu, Xuan Tzu. Those are the Taoist, great, most famous names in Taoism. Which one of you should I take as my teacher? I beg the heavenly Naga kings who guard the Dharma to please indicate the right path to me. Praying silently, he closed his eyes, reached out his hand, and picked a small volume from among the piles of books. It was called Spurring Zen Students Through the Barrier. And he held it up in an attitude of reverence and opened it randomly and began reading. And the part that he opened talked of a certain master, certain monk, Zhu Ming, practicing with a famous master, Fan Yang, who devoted himself to the practice of the way. The bitter cold east of the river kept other students away. Zhu Ming sat alone without sleeping through the long cold nights. To spur himself to greater effort, he told himself, The ancients applied themselves with arduous devotion and attained a purity and radiance that could not help but spread and prosper. Look at me. What am I? I'll be useless if I go on living, and no one will notice if I die. What good am I to the Dharma? So this is what Hakuin, now age 19, read. And it says, when the master read the passage, wisdom that had accumulated from his past lives began to stir within him once again. Once more, a deep and determined faith in the Buddha's Dharma formed in his heart. Casting aside all his previous views and notions, he now took as his guiding principle these words of Zuming. And this is a place to stop for now, so we'll now recite the four vows.